with a wink and a nod. You need a man on a mission from God. Well, not to worry, here's Bob in your life.
Bob in your life.
Yeah, turn up the volume, here's Bob in your life.
Bob in your life. Bob in your life.
Go, Bob.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. This is Bob Enyar, and here at KGov, KGov.com, we are part of America's experiment with internet radio, and we have a guest for today's show who is the founder of Skeptic Magazine. He's also the director of the Skeptic Society. He writes a monthly column for Scientific American. He's the host of the Skeptics Lecture Series at Caltech, and this gentleman has his degrees in psychology and a PhD in history of science, the history of science. His name is Michael Shermer. I want to welcome Michael to the program. How are you, Michael?
Oh, hi. Fine. I'm fine. So we're not on the air? We're on the internet?
We are on the internet. That's right. I'm sorry you weren't aware of that.
Oh, that's all right. No, that's cool. The internet's where the action is.
We've been doing internet talk radio for a couple years now, and our studio's in downtown Denver, and we've got a staff here, and pretty neat. Sometimes we compare ourselves with some of the Denver radio stations revenue-wise, and we're doing pretty well.
Well, good for you.
Thank you very much. And I'm really, when I read through your bio, I told our producer here that we've got the real McCoy on the other end of the line. You have really been in the battle regarding the issue of skepticism, does God exist? And I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, sure. Happy to be on.
I've got to start off with a quick question. I see that you've written a few books, one of them, Why People Believe Weird Things. Great title. And it reminds me of a book I was wondering if you're familiar with. It's a classic, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds.
Of course, Charles McKay. It's great. It's classic. Yeah.
1841. I worked for McDonnell Douglas Helicopter Company for a while. I was in the simulation department. And an engineer in the company, in our department, he was an atheist, and I believe in Jesus Christ and the Bible. And so he gave me that book to read. And I opened it up, it's 740 pages, and Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. And he was saying, Bob, read this and you'll see where you've gone wrong. And I read the book, and apparently he didn't, because it's a fascinating book about how people will believe the most absurd things, very well documented. But the thing is that Charles McKay was a Christian, and through the book, I marked his references to his belief in the Lord Jesus Christ. And that,
I forgot the impression that that book had anything to do with religion.
Well, actually, it wasn't. It was about the foolish things. It's a classic about the madness of crowds, popular delusions, and it is a classic on how people get so easily deluded, and the clarity of the author I attribute to the fact that he was a Christian.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that, but he was a great writer, and he touched on a lot of important subjects of stuff that people believe. And I guess what you're getting at here is the question: is believing in God a weird thing? And the answer is, well, it just depends on to what extent you take your belief and what do you base it on, and so on. I don't really put it in a weird category. I'm mainly interested in the psychology of belief and how people come to believe whatever it is they believe. And so if you take religion, for example, the number one predictor of any religious belief somebody holds is the geographical location on the earth in which they are born and
yes,
the epoch in which they are born.
Mm-hmm.
You were born 5,000 years ago in, India. Well, you wouldn't believe any of this stuff. You had never even heard of Jesus Christ. There was no
right.
religion. There was no even Jewish religion. Nothing. You'd believe something completely different. So,
of course, you wouldn't believe in Jesus Christ, and we have some idea from the earliest surviving documents of early man and civilization. Recorded history tells us that they had religious beliefs, and they typically would make sacrifices to their gods, whether they were animal gods or the sun, the moon, and the stars. And would you agree with this observation, Michael Shermer, that the Bible from the first page on says, do not worship the sun, the moon, or the stars, they're not gods, they're lights.
It says a lot more than that, too.
I agree, but would you agree that it says the sun, moon, and stars are not gods, that they're lights, they were given for lights, so don't worship them?
I don't remember seeing anything about that. It says the first commandment is, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Clearly, there were a lot of gods around at the time, and so the particular Judeo-god that one small group of people in the Levant believed, they said, look, this is the number one god. Well, everybody believes their god's the number one god.
Michael?
The question is, what sets yours apart? Anyway, as we go through...
No, I asked a different... Michael, I asked the question, and in Genesis chapter 1, verse 14, God is talking about the sun and the moon, and he says, let them be for lights. And I could give you a number of quotes in the scriptures that says these things are lights, and it puts down those as incorrect who worship them as gods. So would you at least consent that the Bible, while much of the ancient world was worshiping the sun, the moon, and the stars, the Bible said that they are lights?
Here's what it says. And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. It doesn't say anything about not worshiping them.
No, I said Genesis 1, Genesis 1 says that they're for lights, and then I said that I could go through
the scriptures. Got to do with anything?
Well, I'm just asking you a question. If you would agree that while much of the ancient world was saying the sun and the moon and the stars were lights, the scripture was saying don't worship them.
Yeah, so?
Okay, well, that's just one aspect of biblical cosmology.
It doesn't say don't worship them. Where does it say that? I have the Bible right here. Tell me where it says don't worship them.
Okay. Well, how about this? As we go...
Now you're going to change the subject.
No, I'm not.
I have the Bible here. I have my own Bible I've had since I was a child, presented in 1963 when I was 9 years old. So let's go through it. Where does it say that?
Okay, let's see. I made the statement that in Genesis 1... It says that the sun and the moon and the stars are lights.
There's nothing about moon. It's just the lights in the sky.
Well, there's the greater light and the lesser light to light the day and the night. Okay, so let me think. Let me page through my Bible here. And then I made the statement that later on in the Bible, we find out that the sun and the moon and stars are for lights and do not worship them. I'm thinking about in Jeremiah 31 where the Lord gives the sun for a light by day and the moon and the stars for a light by night. And now what I'm trying to do, are you suggesting what I'm trying to pull out of my memory, flipping through here, something that will show me a specific statement, do not worship the stars. But are you saying that the Hebrew or Christian scriptures says that it's okay to worship the stars, or do they condemn all forms of worship other than the Creator God?
I believe the latter.
Okay, right. So you might be right in that I can't quote a specific verse that says, do not worship the sun.
What has this got to do with anything?
Well, I'm pointing out the cosmology of the ancient Hebrew scriptures, that while much of the world was worshiped... See, I would think, Michael, that this is such a minor point that you would agree with it in a minute.
I don't know what the point is.
Well, I'll say it a third time, that much of the ancient world was worshiping the sun, the moon, and the stars, and the Bible said that they're for lights. They're lights, and only worship the Creator, don't worship the creation.
Well, I think you're reading...
Would you agree with that or no?
Oh, no, I think you're reading between the lines.
Okay, what part of that do you think is incorrect?
I'm trying to get at the larger point here. What's the larger point? That you guys are right and everybody else was wrong?
No, I'd rather not run before we could walk. I'm wondering if you could admit that on that part of the cosmology of the Bible, much of the ancient world was wrong, thinking that the sun and the moon were gods, and the Bible was right, at least in this minor point, that they're for lights.
No, I don't think so.
You can't admit that.
The ancient world was very aware that these were lights.
Well, yeah, but they were worshiping them as gods.
Well, some did, some didn't. Some worshiped trees and rocks.
I understand that. I said much of the ancient world was worshiping these things, like Egypt, for example, and their, what was their sun god's name? Amun-Re, I think. And they had a god that chased him across the sky and would bring the darkness.
Okay, yep.
And my point is, and I'm surprised that you wouldn't concede this, that at least on this minor point, that the cosmology of the Bible is right, that they are not gods, they're lights.
Yeah, but that's not a correct cosmology. It's just a different interpretation.
Well, what's incorrect about saying they're not gods, the sun is a light, it's not a god? What's incorrect about that?
They're not lights.
Oh, the sun is not a light.
No.
The sun does not give light to the earth.
It generates light as a product of fusion.
Yeah, I agree with that. But so the sun is not a light?
But I'm not sure where this is going. I don't get any of this. What is it? I mean, if you lived 10,000 years ago, my point was you wouldn't believe any of this. So your entire belief system is based on the fact that you were born in a certain area at a certain time and that your parents were most likely Judeo-Christian or at least Christian of some kind. And that you were raised to believe, and so on. These are the predictors of what people believe.
Yeah, I agree with that. My father was an agnostic. My mother was a Catholic who was not very committed to her church. And in high school, I became a Christian and started studying. I'd grown up with a fascination for science and evolution, started studying the Bible, and tried to understand it all myself. And my parents were pretty upset about the change in my life. Okay, let's maybe change the topic then, Michael. You have a PhD in the history of science.
Uh-huh.
I've got a question for you. And maybe we did a research project here, and perhaps you can tell me if you think at least our methodology was reasonable. We wanted to find out about the fathers of the physical sciences, whether they were men who defended a natural explanation of origins or who rejected that and defended a belief in creationism. So we gathered a list from before and after Darwin, the fathers of the physical sciences from before and after Darwin, and we filled my office with probably about 100 books of we could beg, borrow, or steal these books from public libraries or buy them. And I also got in my office friends who would read through, and I read through, and we began to collect their quotes. And what we found out is that most of the fathers of the physical sciences, both before and after Darwin, rejected a natural explanation of origins and defended creationism, and most of them biblical creationism. What do you think of that observation? Is that accurate, or did we miss the point?
I'd say pre-Darwin, that's fairly accurate, yes.
Okay, because pre-Darwin, we have Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo and Isaac Newton and on, actually, who made...
Pre-Darwin, it shifted into the 20th century. Einstein, for example, did not believe in God. He's,
right.
Spinoza's God, which is just a reverence for the universe, the cosmos, that kind of thing.
Right, very good
Hawking,
point.
For example, is a noted atheist today. It just depends on who you're talking about.
All right, let me give you a list. Men who we see from their own writings and quotes rejected Darwin, because now we're talking about after Darwin, and defended creationism. Michael Faraday, he's pretty solid, right? Would you say is a father of the physical sciences, father of electromagnetism?
Step back a second and ask where this is going. Are you saying that?
Okay, let me give you a quick...
Basing your faith on the authority?
No. Let me give... What I'm trying to establish is that the scientific method and scientific knowledge is not antithetical to a belief in the biblical creator.
I agree with that.
Let me give you a quick list, and then we'll take a break.
I'll give you the statistics. 40% of American scientists today believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... There you go.
Okay. All right. Let me give you a quick list. We'll take a break and come back and maybe have another statistic for us. From our own research, we found that Michael Faraday, father of electromagnetism, rejected evolution. So did Louis Agassiz, father of glaciology. So did Gregor Mendel, father of genetics. So did Louis Pasteur.
But I'm happy to give you a list of...
Okay, real quick. These are just the fathers... These are the fathers of modern science. And then we'll go to a break. And Michael, if you'd like, right after the break, you could come back and respond. I'd just like you to hear the list we assembled. Louis Pasteur, father of modern microbiology. James Joule, father of thermodynamics, wrote the first law of thermodynamics. Lord Kelvin wrote the second law. Joseph Lister, George Washington Carver, and on right through NASA's Wernher von Braun and so on. Let's take a quick break, and we'd love to continue our conversation with Michael Shermer, founder of the Skeptic Society, well, director of the Skeptic Society, founder of Skeptic Magazine, right after this.
Bob Benyart Live is going to Israel March 21st through the 30th, 2001. We'll be leaving out of New York City for Tel Aviv. We'll spend a night in Tel Aviv, and then we'll go into the Holy Land. And I want to read you one of the days that we're going to be in Israel. It's going to be a very small group, about 40 or so people on a single bus, so you get to know and interact with other Bob Benyart Live fans from around the country. We're going to take a boat ride on the Sea of Galilee, then visit the Mount of Beatitudes, site of the Sermon on the Mount, and the site of the miracles of the loaves and fishes. We're going to proceed to Capernaum and cross the River Jordan and visit Caesarea, Philippi, and the Golan Heights, then return to Tiberias for dinner and the evening. Now that's just one day. Wouldn't that be fun? You get to go to all these different places you've been reading about for so long in the Bible. You get to go on a nice, intimate trip with very few and will be close friends by the end of the trip, I'm sure.
Okay, I want to thank Jason Troyer for giving that plug for our Israel tour. We're excited. We attempt to go to some nation mentioned in the Bible once each year, and we'll be looking forward to next year going to Turkey. It's a bit late to get on board this year, but you can still do it if you've got your passport. Okay, I'd like to get back to Michael Shermer. And, Michael, it is a pleasure to have you with us.
Hi, I'm back.
Okay. So, Michael, the basic point I was making, that scientific, the greatest scientific minds of history have not been antithetical to the Bible's
creator. Some aren't. Come on, you can't make that kind of generalization.
Well,
in any case, you're basing your faith on what some 19th century scientists believe?
No, but what my
point of all this?
Michael,
some
are and some not. My point is the majority of the fathers of the physical scientists rejected natural explanations and defended creationism.
Well,
is
no.
that an accurate statement or no?
It's not an accurate statement, nope.
Okay, well, I've got a list in front of me that's pretty long.
Yeah, but the list is meaningless.
Well, it's not meaningless to my point. My point was that the fathers of the physical sciences, the vast majority of them defended creationism. Now, is that an accurate statement? You have a PhD in the history of science.
But you're calling creationism is not what they would consider to be creation.
Well, I have quotes from them. If I've mentioned any scientists that you think that I've misrepresented, where they...
I mean, this is so silly. I can't believe you make this argument.
Okay, well, the argument is that many of the greatest scientific minds believe in creation.
And there was no evolution. So,
well, after Darwin. That's why I said after Darwin.
Before Darwin, everybody believed in creationism before Darwin. So what?
That's not true. Evolution goes back to the ancient Greeks.
Point of all this.
In a belief that we've evolved out of the sea.
Are you trying to argue that you have scientific proof that your religion is correct, that of the 10,000 religions in the world today, yours is the one and only one that's correct and all the others are wrong?
No, I'm not trying to argue that. I'm trying to argue that you can reach the pinnacle of scientific learning and still affirm a belief in the Bible's, in the creator of the Bible.
That's true.
Okay. That's it. It was hard to get that, but thank you for agreeing with that. Now, I have quite a few arguments that I believe show that there's a creator God. I would be happy to go with you either way. For you, would you like to present arguments that there is not? Or would you like to, and then I respond, or would you like me to give you some arguments?
I cover all this in my book, How We Believe.
Mm-hmm.
There is no possible way to prove scientifically that there is or is not a God.
I disagree with that.
I cannot prove to you that there is no creator, there is no God. But I can do this. I can show you how religion and belief in God is socially constructed and psychologically developed. It happens historically.
Well, obviously that's true, Michael.
By, as I said, the time of the the epoch in which you're born, the place on the planet in which you're born.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're a Yanomamo living in Brazil, you're not going to believe, you're not going to be a Christian, you're not going to believe in the Bible.
Sure.
Okay. So clearly.
That's true. And Michael, I could show you that evolution had social developments that in some ways it went kicking and screaming against the science of mathematics and genetics. But yet there was a strong social desire to explain our origins apart from a God. And so it had a tremendous amount of steam behind it. Right? Couldn't I show that also?
The history of evolutionary thought is an interesting one. It hit much resistance throughout the earliest part of the 20th century until genetics started to catch up with paleontology, and there was a corroboration between different independent fields in which there was a sort of convergence of evidence toward the conclusion that evolution happened. I mean, you think, oh my God, this really happened.
Okay, you just...
So for people to believe, because it's such a long time frame, it's not on a human time scale, and most people actually don't know that much about evolution.
They right, sure.
Get it from bits and pieces here and there, but it's it's a full science and so on.
But I imagine you've read...
Oh, but is there a God or not?
Okay, Michael, you just brought up paleontology and microbiology, and you said that those two converge to support this theory of evolution.
Uh-huh.
I've got a question for you. Do you think I could produce a list of published quotes from authorities in evolution who say that it's difficult to find the evidence for evolution in the fossil record? Do you think I could produce a list of published quotes?
I've seen Gish's list that he sends out to everybody. Yeah.
No, I've got my own list.
Well, okay.
I don't know Gish. I've never met Gish. I've never heard him speak. But I have my own list. I have a question. Do you think I could – let's take, for example, flowering plants. Do you think I could provide a list from an authoritative evolutionist published who says that the fossil record of the evolution of flowering plants is a mystery, and we do not know from the fossil record how it happened?
If it's old enough, yeah, you can probably find somebody that said – you can find somebody that says anything.
The evolution
of flowers, this is a done deal. We understand that now. No botanist is going to say it's a mystery. We don't know where flowers came from. This is pretty well understood now.
Okay.
If you found a quote from the 1950s or something, yeah, you can probably find somebody that said that.
Okay. Now that you've said that, what I want to do, it should only take me a second here. I'm going to get you a quote on the fossil record of the evolution of plants. All right? And let's agree that I won't use any quotes earlier than the 1950s. How about that?
Okay.
How about from 1993? In Patterson, Williams, and Humphreys' Annual Review of Ecology, page 170, the origin of angiosperms, that's flowering plants, was an abominable mystery to Darwin, and it remained so 100 years later. I'll quote to you from Introduction to Paleo.
Is that the end of that quote?
That's the end of that quote.
All right. So Darwin's 1859. So he said up to 100 years. So that's 1959.
Well, this...
Writing in 1993. Why is he saying that?
Because they don't present... You could look up Annual Review of Ecology and Systematics. This was written in 1993.
I do understand angiosperms quite well.
Okay, but he wrote it in that way maybe to give somebody a loophole out of his quote. But are you saying that you can quote a book for me that documents the fossil record of the evolution of flowering plants? Which book does that?
Oh, you can look at any of Gould's books. He does it nicely.
I've read some of Gould's books, and I don't recall that, actually. Which book? You name the title? Which book?
Angiosperms I'll give it to you here. Got it right here. Bully for Brontosaurus. You might check that out.
That's not about flowering plants, I don't think.
It's a collection of essays. It's about a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, which book of Gould's shows us the photographs and documents the names of the fossils that show the development of flowering plants?
Any textbook on the evolution of flowers, flowering plants, angiosperms, you'll see it.
If you could, you're an expert. If you could name one, I will go get the book and report back to the audience. Because when this here was written in 1993...
Let's get to the point here.
All right.
What is the point of all this? What are you trying to say?
Well, I just happen to pick flowering plants.
Evolution is a theory in trouble, and that all these people that are professional evolutionary biologists, that what are they doing when they're working?
Okay. Do you think I could quote from an expert on vertebrate evolution saying that there is a that there's a complete lack of transitional forms in the fossil record? Do you think I could quote an expert?
If evolution is wrong, does that mean there's a God?
No, but it makes your argument a lot harder.
So in other words, if A is wrong, that doesn't make B right. It just means A is wrong.
Right, I agree with that. But you didn't. Do you think I could quote from an expert on vertebrate evolution saying that that they cannot find on vertebrate evolution, that they have a backbone, that they cannot find transitional forms from invertebrates to vertebrates? I've got a quote in front of me from 1998, Alfred Fisher. I don't know if you've heard of him. And he...
No.
Okay, he's written the article in Grolier Encyclopedia, 1998. One of the most difficult problems has been the almost abrupt appearance of the major animal groups in full-fledged form. This must reflect a sudden acquisition of skeletons by the various groups, in itself a problem. How many groups suddenly, instantly appearing in the fossil record now have backbones, skeletons? Do you think, Michael, that I'd have a hard time multiplying quotes by experts, authorities in the evolutionary field, lamenting the lack of a fossil record for transitions?
Let me ask you this. Are you that intensely interested in the science of evolutionary biology, or do you have some other agenda here?
I grew up studying evolution. I believed in evolution, and I was confronted with the fact that evolutionary authorities were stating in every field that there was a lack of transitional fossils in their field.
There's lots of transitional.
And I began...
In transitional fossils for its own sake. If you were, you'd go take paleontology. You're interested in it because you want to prove that your religion is correct, and evolution has nothing to do with religion.
Well,
it doesn't. It's a science. It has nothing to do with Christianity.
I've got 1985 vertebrate history. None of the known fishes is thought to be directly ancestral to the earliest land vertebrates.
All right. Fine.
And that those
so what
that,
does this mean?
The first, let's see. Most of them lived after the first amphibians appeared, and those that came before show no evidence of developing the stout limbs and ribs that characterize the primitive tetrapods. Literally hundreds of quotes I have, Michael, from authorities lamenting that they don't have the transitional forms in the fossil record, yet people tell the public that the fossil record is filled with transitional forms, and we know it all. We know, like you're saying, I believe you're misrepresenting the fossil record of flowering plants.
Well, you're wrong. But let's say you're right.
Okay, name me one fossil that's been found that led to the American rose. Or any flowering plant. Name me the fossil that led to it.
There's not one. There's not one single transitional fossil anywhere for anything.
Well, there should be hundreds of thousands leading to fossil flowering plants.
But so what?
When the paleobotanists say they're not there, then I believe them and I doubt you.
So
that's
what? What to do? You're not interested. I'm telling you, you're not interested in evolutionary biology. You have no interest in it at all. You're a Christian trying to prove that you're the one true religion. If you want to study evolution, go do it. Go join the ranks of evolutionary biology. Go study it.
That's
what you're interested in doing. So let's cut.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question about Lucy.
You're being deceitful here. You're not telling us what you're really up to.
I believe in God.
Up to. Okay. Here
I believe in God, and I believe that the scientific enterprise has given overwhelming evidence that God exists. Let me ask you about Lucy or Australopithecus.
All right. Give me your best shot at what's the best evidence that God exists. Go ahead. Give it to me.
Okay. That a fire cannot burn forever, and a rock cannot make itself.
Okay.
Those are the first two laws of thermodynamics.
Your faith is based on fires and rocks.
Yeah. Yeah, what is yours based on?
I don't have faith.
Okay. Your belief system. I base my belief system on evidence. And the more concrete the evidence, the better. A fire cannot burn forever, and a rock cannot make itself out of nothing. So that's the second law and the first law.
No one says that it did. So who's saying that it did? Well, you are. You're saying that God created a...
No, I'm not.
It can't be created out of nothing, because that's what you said God did.
The sun, moon, and stars...
Where'd they come from?
The sun and the stars could not have burned forever.
Okay, so where'd they come from?
Ancients believed that they could have. There were many ancients who believed that they
could... Where do you think they came from?
Well...
Where do you think rocks and fire came from?
A supernatural God brought them into existence. They did not create themselves from nothing.
How do you know that?
Because I believe in the laws of science... that you cannot have, under the physical laws of the natural universe, that matter nor energy can be created nor destroyed.
But God is, the word God, G-O-D, is just a word to describe something you don't understand.
Right, but let me give you a concept that there is something apart from the physical universe.
God did it, and me saying it did it.
But you don't believe in God. You believe in the laws of the physical universe, but you have to believe in rocks that created themselves out of nothing and a fire or work activity that's continued forever. You got to believe in one or the other of those things. And I'm saying that those two things are contradictory to the most fundamental laws of all the physical sciences.
I created rocks. Where did you get that?
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
You read it in a book.
Well, before...
So how do you know the Bible's
philosophers
right?
Philosophers and scientists...
4,000 years ago, how do you know it's right?
Say that again?
The book upon which you're basing these beliefs was written 4,000 years ago.
Right.
You know it's right.
When I first read that book, I didn't believe it. I thought it was incorrect. But what happened was I began to study science and evolution, and I thought that evolution... I saw that evolutionists showed me in their own writings that the evidence for evolution was not there. And then I started studying microbiology and reading books by microbiologists like Dr. Lee Spetner. Maybe you remember him. He's the one who first published the mutation rates of various organisms. And he shows how it violates the fundamental laws of microbiology to think that you could increase the information in the DNA of an organism. And there's no experimental evidence that it happens, and there's no theoretical evidence that it can happen.
Let me ask you this. If I was to prove to you that evolution happened, would you quit being a Christian? Would you give it all up? Is that what you're telling me?
If I was to prove to you that evolution did not happen, would you reconsider your understanding of origins?
You're answering my question with a question?
Right, I am.
I'm curious about you. Just you.
If I've answered that question on the air many times, if I found out that evolution was true, if I showed the evidence and then I was compelled to assent to it because it was clear and overwhelming, then I would have to rethink my belief in the Bible. I would rethink it.
There's actually a lot of evolutionary biology.
I understand that, but I'm interested in the truth.
They're Christians.
Yeah, I know. We know that.
Are they flawed in their thinking? How is?
I think they're flawed because they're ignoring the physical scientific evidence. Let me ask you about Lucy. Right, supposedly we have Australopithecines in our ancient history, going back a few million years.
Uh-huh.
Do you believe that? Okay. Since now the Human Genome Project and other organisms like an E. coli, worms, we're beginning to identify the entire chain of amino acids that make up an organism. And we can start to quantify the difference between human beings, Homo sapiens, and Australopithecine. And I have a question. Johansson said that Lucy lived about 3 million years ago.
About 2.5 million.
Yeah. How many genetic changes are there between that creature and Homo sapien today?
Not just genetic changes that matter. It's the interaction between genes, DNA.
I agree.
DNA, and proteins.
I agree. That all makes it more complicated. I'm trying to keep it simple.
Complex system.
Do you think there are a few...
Right now, for example, the difference between human genome and the flatworm genome is 13,000 genes and 30,000 genes. So
right.
Really, it's not just the genes that matter.
Yeah, I understand that. But my question to you is, is it of scientific interest to quantify what the percentage change or the actual number of genetic differences between apes and human beings? Is that of scientific interest to know that?
I'd like to get back to this. I don't know.
No, I'm going on a line of thought, Michael, that I'd really appreciate you to answer.
I don't think you're interested.
I'm very interested.
I don't want to talk about science. I want to
that, you know, we find that my audience knows that that's true of most evolutionists that come on this show. Let me make my point, and if you want to go on to another point, you can.
I thought you wanted to talk about religion.
No, I want to talk about science.
Hi.
My point is that there have been millions, we now know that there have been millions of changes in the DNA from 2.5 million years ago to today. Millions of changes. And evolutionists say we can't see evolution happening because it happens so slowly. And for those millions of changes to have occurred from Lucy to today's New York Post, we would have had to be on a locomotive of genetic mutations in a positive direction every year, reproducing themselves throughout the community at an incredibly blazing fast rate to get from Lucy to today.
That's not true.
It's not true? Let's say you had a child who had a genetic improvement, and it would benefit the whole human race if it got to everybody. In 100 years from now, how many people would have your son's improved DNA?
How would you get it to everybody? What are you talking about?
Well, through when you reproduce and you have kids. And your son, then a generation later, has two kids. And so now two people have this improved genetic definition. And then a generation later, there might be four. And maybe seven, and then 11, and 30, and 50, and...
It doesn't work that way.
Oh, it doesn't. That's not how genetics, that's not how a positive mutation gets replicated through the community?
No, there's lots of you can't go, there's not a straight line from Lucy to us. It's a bush in which most of the lineages, well, in fact, all of them but one, went extinct.
Yeah, but as
all humans living today come from a single population.
Yeah, creationists argue that against Darwin. Right.
Years ago.
The evolutionist said we were different races, and Darwin's racism came through in his writings. And the creationist quoted Luke in the book of Acts saying we are all one family.
I don't see much point in having this conversation because you really don't understand what you're talking about. So we should talk about religion because that's what you're into. You're not into science. Religion.
Isn't that funny? I want to talk about science.
No, you don't. You think you do. You're pretending that you're interested in science, but you have an agenda. The point of your science is to find why it's wrong and supports your belief in the Bible.
If scientific evidence showed me there is no God, if I had strong evidence to that...
How would you prove that?
Well, I prove to you, you see, a rock cannot make itself from nothing. Therefore, by the laws of science...
It says that a rock makes itself from nothing.
You do.
No, I don't. No scientists would ever say that. What are you talking about?
You either believe one of these two things.
No, you're wrong.
That the universe has been here forever.
You're right there. I'm not going to let you go on. That is not correct.
Okay.
Not an either-or choice.
Do you believe the universe has been here forever, perpetually functioning in some way?
No, I don't know. Nobody knows.
Okay, you don't believe...
No, I didn't say that. I said nobody knows.
Well, you first said no, and then you said nobody knows.
Believe... Okay, listen. You're trying to trap me. You're playing these little word games. You creationists are so small-minded.
Scientifically, show me how my... Okay, I'll state my argument in one sentence, and you could show me the scientific flaw in it. If the universe... If we state that the universe has been here functioning forever, we're violating the second law of thermodynamics.
How would you ever prove that? Forever
we're postulating it. We're saying, could the universe have been here functioning forever? And because of the increase in entropy and heat loss, I maintain that it couldn't be because there's still a lot of work getting done.
Nobody says it's lived here forever. Who says?
Okay, good. So we know that the universe is not perpetual and hasn't been working forever.
What do you mean by the universe?
Everything that exists in the physical world.
It'd be other
world.
Universes.
I think you have a hard enough time dealing with ours. Can we limit to ours?
Don't you know about inflationary cosmology and multiple bubble universes?
Yeah, and I also know about Casper the Friendly Ghost.
True, from Big Bang to Big Crunch to Big Bang.
I also know about Casper the Friendly Ghost, and I'd like to talk about scientific laws that are well established.
There's now some experimental evidence that there are these multiple bubble universes.
That's not true.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
Very interesting.
No, it's not true.
Yes, it is.
That's
very, very interesting that there are these other multiple universes.
There's experimental evidence that they exist.
They are starting to do some tests to show.
You just said there's experimental evidence that bubble universes exist.
Quantum computing, for example.
Would you like to correct that statement, Michael?
Certain things can happen only if there are other universes in existence.
Mm.
Interesting, huh? Now look, so here's the deal, is that nobody is saying that the universe just came into existence, you know, always on its own, has always been there. Nobody says that.
Okay,
nobody knows what there was before the universe.
Okay, Michael, let's try to see what we agree on scientifically.
Where did God come from?
You and I agree.
Okay, now let me ask you that.
No, Michael, Michael, you and I agree scientifically that the universe is not perpetual.
Hey, Mr. Science, where did God come from?
He always was there.
Okay, the universe was always there.
It can't. The difference is
the
universe.
Both ways.
The universe is subject to the physical laws of science, Michael.
It has to obey the laws of
Michael.
Nature, so you can't have it both ways.
Michael, you're wrong. The universe is subject to the physical laws of nature. A supernatural creator,
and that he doesn't have to obey the laws. Yes, he does. If God is all powerful and all knowing and all present, he is part of the universe. He has to obey the laws of physics, and therefore he could not have always been around. You just contradicted me.
Michael, if you want to refute theism intellectually and honestly, then you have to refute theism. You can't refute your own ideas. You have to refute...
For this universe has always been around. Why can't we just say that, and you just keep saying it? So the word, the difference, you have the word God, the word universe...
I'll answer your question.
These are just words.
I'll answer your question. Because theist... We state that there is a supernatural creator that exists outside of the physical universe, and that's why he's not subject to the physical laws of science.
Wait a minute. You said the universe is everything.
I said every physical thing that exists.
Apparently it's not. Apparently there's something.
I agree it's not. What theism states, Michael, and you should know this because you devote your life to opposing it. Theists state that there's a supernatural creator outside of the physical universe, and that the physical universe is subject to the laws of science, and that the supernatural creator is not subject to the natural laws. That's what we posit, and that's what you'd have to refute logically if you can do that.
I think this is just a waste of time.
It's not for me or my audience.
Yeah? Do you even have an audience? Who's listening to this?
Well, how about this? You want to give out your office phone number and we'll ask people to call you?
Sure.
Okay. Go ahead.
Now, you know what? I don't want to do that.
Okay. I think that was a wise decision. We're not huge here, but
I mean up here.
We're not huge here, but we have an annual budget of over $250,000 and we operate over the internet and we have a great time.
Look, we're dealing here with some of the ultimate questions that cannot be answered. They're insoluble.
I think they can be answered.
You can answer.
You've just admitted logical defeat.
If you want to believe all this stuff, you can.
If I want to believe the first two laws of thermodynamics?
And that's yeah, but
I do believe them. Do you?
Most scientists do not accept the argument you're making. So either you're right and they're all wrong, or you're wrong.
Well, there are thousands of scientists who do believe, including, by the way, Lord Kelvin and James Joule, who gave us the laws of thermodynamics. They agree with my interpretation.
But you got to catch up. You're way behind. We've learned a lot in the last 100 years.
Yeah, but okay, then take from what we've learned and scientifically refute my argument.
Okay, I'm going to go. This is a waste of my time.
Okay. I think it went very well. I think it went very well. In Michael Shermer, we have one of the brightest evolutionists working in America today. Here is who he is, all right? He's written a few books. He's got another one coming out. I gave you part of his bio, but let me tell you a little bit more. He has, let's see here, where should we start? He has his PhD in the history of science from Claremont Graduate School, his MS in experimental psychology from California State University, Fullerton. He also has a BS in psychology. He's been on 2020, Dateline, Tom Snyder, Politically Incorrect, Donahue, Oprah, Unsolved Mysteries, Discovery Channel, The History Channel, The Learning Channel. He's the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He's the director of the Skeptic Society. He's a monthly columnist for Scientific American. And after this, by the way, after this, we'll end the show a little short. We'll just end the show here because I think it's been worthwhile. He co-hosted and produced the 13-hour Fox Family television series. He's an author. Let's see. He got his BA in psychology, his BA in psychology from Pepperdine University. He's pretty much at the top of the evolutionary food chain in America. He's right up there. And when he said, when I asked him how long before the genetic improvement, the mutation in your son got to the whole population, in 20 years, how many people would have that improvement? In 100 years, in 1,000 years. You know, I asked him that because if you take a population of, say, 10 million or so, which is pretty small, and you have a mutation, it's going to take about 20,000 generations among apes, 20,000 generations before that one mutation could permeate through the whole population. And here he said the whole human race is from one genetic source, just from one. So that if we have 5 million genetic differences between us and Lucy, or Australopithecus, we have 5 million genetic changes in 2.5 million years. And if it's going to take 20,000 generations, or let's say 400,000 years, for one genetic change to go from Lucy to everybody in the population, almost 500,000 years. Well, that can only happen 5 or 6 times. You cannot get 5 million genetic changes in that short period of time. And he saw that he saw where that was going. And he said, oh, evolution is not a straight line. It's a bush. That has nothing to do with genetic mutations as a source of evolution. That's what they believe. But they believe that that didn't happen one time. It happened 10,000 times and only one has survived, which is a lot more difficult to cause to happen. So I enjoyed it. I think it went well. We thought he might stick with us for 5 minutes, and we got about 40 out of him. So he exceeded our expectations for a leading evolutionist. He didn't quite hang in there, though, with the likes of Eugenie Scott, who sat with a cat on her lap for a full hour, not debating Bob Enyard on the subject of evolution. Because as she said at the end of the show, and we agreed with her, Bob, I don't debate. Eugenie, that's obvious. It was fun. I enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it. Well, let's flag that tape. We'll mark it for our apologetics series that we may put together sometime here. This is Bob Enyard reminding you to do right and risk the consequences. And